Morning, Graham Church. What would happen if God were put on trial for all the stuff that people have done wrong, people think he has done wrong? C.S. Lewis actually wrote a provocative little essay. It's called God in the Dock. Now, the dock is where the defendant is put. And if God were the defendant and God were put on trial, what would happen? C.S. Lewis suggests that we human beings have come to the place where we no longer see ourselves standing before God in judgment, but we put God on trial. We act as God's judge. We accuse God. We say, well, you allow evil and you cause poverty and disease and you don't do anything to stop all of this. And you lie to us. So what would happen if God were put on trial? Well, the answer to that is found here pretty clearly in Matthew chapter 26, because that's what happens here. We're looking at the end of Matthew's gospel, and we're looking at what is, of course, the final days of Jesus' life on earth. Jesus has just been snared by this crowd, by a group of soldiers sent by the Jewish leadership, and he's taken in, and he's going to be put on trial for his life. He's challenged by the court to testify on his own behalf. And in any case, in any trial where the defendant is being charged with a capital crime, the defendant could be put to death, and then the defendant is asked to testify on his own behalf, that is dramatic. That is shocking. And it appears, as we look at this case, as we read in Matthew 26, that Jesus Christ is the one being judged. And of course he is. But the deeper reality is that the judge of the universe puts humanity on trial. There's a real sense in which you and I and the rest of humanity is standing before the God of gods here in this case. What we're going to see here are two things. First, how Jesus is the judge who was judged. And second, how understanding this reality makes us thankful. First, Jesus is the judge who was judged. Now, this is a long set of verses that Anna has read, and it basically breaks down into three short stories, three little paragraphs. First, Jesus is arrested, and Judas betrays him, and there's this little struggle, and some blood is shed, and Jesus is taken in. Second paragraph Jesus is placed on trial before the Jewish leadership council. And then third, Peter denies Jesus during that trial. And in all three of these paragraphs, all three of these events, Jesus is judged by the wrong standard. You have God in the dock, God on trial, and he's being judged by man-made rules. How does that happen? Well, first, we judge Jesus by the wrong kingdom. That's 47 to 56, first paragraph there. We judge Jesus by the wrong kingdom. The crowd comes to arrest Jesus. They're armed with swords and clubs. They're expecting to beat somebody up. They're expecting a fight. They approach Jesus like he's some kind of heavily armed generalissimo with an army. They're expecting to get a fight back. So why do they come like this? Why do they come armed so heavily and just aiming for a fight? Because they know that Jesus has been talking an awful lot about God's kingdom. And he's been doing some pretty powerful things to back it up. They can take no chances. They figured this arrest, this thing had to be quick. It had to be at night. It had to be outside the city, because this guy's been stirring up a revolution. He must be stopped. Then one of Jesus' guys, in the Gospel of John tells us it's Peter, starts to defend Jesus. Pulls out a sword. He cuts off the servant's ear. And Jesus says, of course, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Now, Jesus is not preaching pacifism here. You know what pacifism is? That pacifism is what the Amish practice, that we won't fight, we won't ever go to war. Jesus is not teaching that there's no just war, that Jesus is not teaching you should never defend yourself. That's not what's going on here at all. No. He's saying, Peter, you have totally misunderstood my mission. You don't get the cross, do you, Peter? I didn't come to fight my way into God's kingdom. I came to die. I came to give myself for sinners like you. I didn't come to give judgment. I came to bear divine judgment. I came to take the sword that you deserve. And that basically means, Peter, that you have completely misunderstood the kingdom that I've been talking about. God's kingdom is not accomplished by military muscle. Look, guys, I mean, I could call a whole army of angels ready to defend me if that's what I wanted. Have you forgotten who I am? Have you missed what's going on here? Have you forgotten that the promises of the Bible are being fulfilled right here, right now? So I think what's going on is that Peter, at this moment, has forgotten the gospel of self-substitution. Peter believes the gospel of self-salvation. I got to do it. I got to go to war. I got to fight. He's fighting for the wrong kingdom, his own kingdom. Then Jesus turned to the mob and he says, look, guys, you're also fulfilling the promises of the Bible by arresting me in this way. So all of them are judging Jesus by the wrong kingdom. We misunderstand what he's doing. We misunderstand how he's coming. And for some reason, every one of them, everybody there, Jesus' friends and Jesus' enemies, still seem to think that he's going to bring a military solution to a problem that at its roots is spiritual. We do the very same thing. We think that the methods of human strength, the methods of the world, the methods that can be bought by money or by might or by power are going to accomplish things in our hearts that really are spiritually driven. What Matthew is showing us here is that we must not think that Jesus approaches success and power the way that the world does. We think that our root problems can be solved by human strength. The issues in my marriage, the struggles in my finances, my health and the discouragement that brings into my life. And when God doesn't deliver right on schedule as I think he should, then we do exactly what the disciples did there in verse 56. And all the disciples left him and fled. Why did they run away? Because they misunderstood the kingdom. They've been with the Lord for 3 years, and they still don't get it. They think all of a sudden that they're in danger, that they've been sold out. They think all of a sudden that this kingdom plan that they've been looking forward to has completely fallen apart. So they cut and run. We judge Jesus by the wrong kingdom. Second, we judge Jesus by misplaced expectations, and that's 57 to 68. Misplaced expectations. So after Jesus is arrested, he's taken to the Jewish leadership council. He's taken to this fellow named Caiaphas, who is the chief priest, and he appears there before, this is the Jewish trial. There's a Jewish trial and there's a Roman trial, and this is the Jewish side of the trial. And the Jews bring him and they charge him with religious crimes. They're determined to get rid of this Jesus problem by any means necessary. So they decide that they're going to hold a trial in the middle of the night, 2:00 in the morning. Now, you don't have to think real deep to think, why would a person hold a trial for a capital crime at 2:00 in the morning? You don't have to think about that real long, because they want to railroad him. They want to get rid of him. So they get a lineup of liars to come and testify against him. And the problem that they have is that no two of these liars seem to agree with each other. They can't get their story straight because they haven't worked on it. Why? Why can't they get their story straight? Because everything they say is fiction. Finally, they get two of them, verse 61, to say, this man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. And Caiaphas says, how do you answer that, Jesus? He says nothing at all. He stands mute. He's not going to testify. He's not going to dignify this sham trial and all of these lies by presenting an argument. You see, there's nothing about this trial that is legal. There's nothing about it that is just. It is a miscarriage of justice from the beginning to the end. They should just dismiss the case. They should throw it out. They don't. Instead, the high priest, in his frustration, asks Jesus point blank, and this is the heart of the passage, and arguably one of the key passages in the whole book of Matthew. Are you the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, we have to understand what Caiaphas is asking. In the expectation of the time, first century Jewish culture, they believed that a Messiah would come who would be like a Davidic king. He would be like a king in the line of David. Maybe a king who actually was descended from David. And this king would come and he would rise up and help Israel to throw off the yoke of its Roman oppressors. But this person that they expected, this Messiah, was a very human person. And even though David had been called the Son of the Blessed One, and other kings have been called Son of the Blessed One, and the Messiah was being called the Son of the Blessed One, that doesn't indicate divinity. Caiaphas is not saying that this one who is coming is God. When David is called the Son of God, what he's indicating is closeness to God and the favor of God, not divinity. So the high priest, when he asked Jesus, are you the Christ, and not saying, are you the Son of God in the sense of a real Son of God? He's just asking, are you the Messiah we're expecting? Are you the one that everybody's been looking forward to? Jesus' response is astonishing, shocking. First, he says, yeah, but he doesn't stop there. He says, I am, and I am a Messiah infinitely bigger than you bargained for. Then he says, I am the Son of Man too. The Son of Man was a figure presented in Daniel chapter 7 and all of the ruling council. Now, these are people who knew their Bible pretty well. And all the Sanhedrin knows what the Son of Man is. Jesus says, I am the Son of Man. And the Son of Man in Daniel chapter 7 comes from the throne of God to earth in the clouds of heaven to judge the world. You have to remember, the clouds of heaven are not the same as the clouds of the earth. You walk outside, it's cloudy day, you're foggy. That's not what this is. This is not the clouds of the atmosphere. Those clouds of the atmosphere are just water vapor, and you all know that. The clouds of heaven are the Shekinah glory, the glory of God. And the very glory and being of God. And Jesus is saying, I will come to earth in the very glory of God at the time of the end and judge the entire world and put all evil down. That's the Messiah who I am. It's an astounding statement. He's making a claim to deity. And it's way beyond what he's actually being asked to confess to. Of course, this is an unbelievably high challenge. You know what he's saying? He's saying, you guys, you think you're judges, but I'm the judge. So be careful, because regardless of what you do to me here, regardless of what happens, regardless of the outcome of this trial, says Jesus, I will be back as judge of all the earth. And it's an amazing statement. You know that because just as soon as Jesus claims deity, just as soon as Jesus claims to be God, the judge of all the earth, immediately the response is explosive. You see the explosion? You see the detonation here? The high priest rips his garments apart, which is the sign of the greatest possible outrage and horror and grief. And not only that, the situation deteriorates. The situation, it's no longer a trial. I mean, even though this is a show trial, even though the outcome was preordained, they were trying to at least go through the motions so that they could, in their consciences, feel like they had done something with a semblance of justice here, even though that wasn't their intention. So now this is no longer a trial. These are the jurors. These are the judges, and they go nuts. They begin to spit on him and slap him and hit him in the middle of the trial. Can you imagine? I mean, just in your wildest dreams, imagine going up to Corona to the courthouse and you're there for capital murder trial. And, you know, hypothetically, the person could be put to death and the defendant says something. The judge and the jury, they get out of their boxes and they come out, they're beating the guy to pieces. Just imagine that. They go absolutely berserk. There is an explosion when he claims to be God, the judge, coming down to earth to put down all injustice. So when Jesus claimed not just to be a great human being, a great teacher, a great leader, but the divine judge of all the earth, it's explosive. Have you ever noticed how people respond when they actually see who Jesus came to be? When a human being says, I am God, I'm judge of all who live, I have power over heaven and earth. When a human being says that, people will respond. You know, people like Jesus to be Santa Claus. Yeah, people have no problem with Jesus who is Santa Claus. Nobody's accountable to Santa Claus. I know we sing that silly song, but you know, nobody's really accountable to Santa Claus. But when he says, I am the judge of all the earth, and you will all appear before me and give an account of your lives and everything that you have thought and done, people go crazy. You either hate him, or you will be scared to death of him and run away, or you will fall on your faces and worship him. When a human being says, I have absolute authority over you and I will judge you, you cannot stay neutral. If you stay neutral, if you say, you know, I'm not sure what, then you haven't heard. You haven't grasped. You really haven't sunk in what Jesus is claiming for himself. What you simply cannot say is, oh, yeah, you know, I believe in Jesus and I think I'll drop into church every once in a while. Yeah, you know, I've got this little religious compartment of my life, and yeah, I'll let Jesus have that compartment of my life. You simply can't do that. Because if he is who he claims to be, everything in your life has to revolve around him. He's not content to be a part-time God. He's not going to be a standoff savior. He's the king and the judge of the earth. So these people judge Jesus because he's not what they expected. He's far beyond that. He blows their minds. Don't think that Jesus is going to appear to you and act exactly as you think he should. He's not God in a box. He's far greater than these people ever imagined. He's far greater than you ever imagined. So how do we judge Jesus? We judge Jesus by misunderstanding his kingdom completely, by the wrong kingdom. We judge Jesus because he doesn't fit into our expectations. And third, we judge Jesus by an arrogant self-reliance. I really do. You know, you might come up with a better phrase. I'm sure you could come up with a better phrase to describe this meltdown of Peter in verses 69 to 75. I've called it an arrogant self-reliance. You follow Peter's story through. You really have to read all of chapter 26 to get Peter's story because it's there all through the chapter. 33, Peter answered him, though they fall away because of you, I will never fall away. Jesus said to him, I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Verse 56, at the end, all the disciples left him and fled. Verse 58, Peter followed him at a distance and sits outside in the courtyard. Peter had pledged on his life that he would never leave Jesus, but he does. Now, here in verse 69, at the end of the chapter, Peter is confronted with a dilemma. Will he take ownership of this man who is on trial inside? And he denies Jesus three times. He doesn't just deny him. The text is pretty graphic. He denies him by cursing and swearing with an oath. Then the rooster crows, just as Jesus said he would. Now here's Peter. Peter has been called by Christ. He lived with Christ for three long years of intensive discipleship. Peter is not a new convert. He's not inexperienced. He'd had an intimate relationship with the one who did great wonders. He'd seen Jesus raise the dead. And I can imagine, in my mind's eye, I'm doing a little guesswork here, but I can imagine that if Jesus had commanded Peter to stand beside him and defend the Lord, whatever the cost, with his sword, Peter would have mustered the courage to take on that whole army of soldiers. He would have found the courage to fight the temple police, even if it killed him. But here Peter crashes and burns under a far less intense heat. Wouldn't you love to know what was going through Peter's head when he walks up and wants to see the trial from a distance? Maybe he had a plan. Maybe his plan was that the soldiers are going to see me. Some of the soldiers might recognize me. They're going to come and confront me. And when the soldiers come and argue with me, I will defend myself and I'll fight to the death. But instead, he's confronted by a gossipy girl. Peter seems to have been prepared to battle on his own terms, but he wasn't prepared to battle on the devil's terms, and he wasn't prepared to battle on Christ's terms. Because of his self-assurance, Peter had neglected. The Lord had warned him. Peter had neglected the Lord's warning to watch and pray. He hadn't done that. So, consequently, he was blindsided from a source that he never expected. Yeah, I can fight the devil. I'll take him on. And then, boom, the devil slides right in where he wasn't looking. John MacArthur. It is when we get caught off guard that our true character is most likely to show itself. Peter's proud self-reliance was his Achilles heel. So what happened? What happened is Peter had convinced himself that he was strong enough to withstand any test. The test came and he failed. He made a promise. The trial came and he broke his promise. We all do it, don't we? We're all guilty of this. Don't stand in judgment of Peter. I mean, this is describing me. Every one of us are guilty of pride and thinking that we can handle this thing ourselves. We can do this alone. We can face any temptation. And when you and I do that, we are effectively denying the cross. That is, somehow in thinking that I can dig my way out of the strap that I get myself in, I'm denying the necessity of the cross. I can do this. I don't need Jesus. I can handle this. I don't need Jesus to go and die on the cross for me. Peter doesn't seem to think that Jesus really had to sacrifice everything to rescue him. And what he came to realize is, I am helpless. My situation is hopeless. And by the end of verse 75, the very tail end of the chapter, Peter recognizes that. It wasn't until Peter saw the Lord's face and remembered the Lord's words, Peter came to his senses and realized how helpless and hopeless he was in sin, and he repented and turned from that. Jesus is the judge who was judged. Everybody misunderstood him. He wasn't what they expected. He's far greater, far more powerful. So, what does this mean for me? It's a long set of verses. How does understanding this reality make us thankful? It is Thanksgiving week. I briefly want to give you four ways that this truth, the truth that Jesus is the judge who was judged, how can this change you and make you thankful? By the way, do you really believe that Jesus was the judge who was judged? If so, number one, four ways. Number one, be thankful that you're not the judge. Be thankful that you're not the judge. When you know that Jesus is the judge of all the earth, you will not sit in judgment on other people. Basically, what he says in verse 64 is that I am the divine judge of all the earth. I am, and you're not. So what is sin? Sin is substituting yourself for God, putting yourself on the throne of your life and taking God off the throne of your life. Sin is saying to God, sin, what is sin? Sin is saying to God, I am judge and you are not. I am king and you are not. I deserve to be judge and you deserve God to be judged by me. The gospel is Jesus saying, I am judge and I find you guilty. Humanity is on trial and you're found guilty. But I will take your place and be judged for you. Jesus' greatness is not just that he has infinite power, but that he gave up his power and sacrificed himself and died to forgive his enemies. If you're a Christian and you look at people who don't think the way you do, don't believe the way you do, and you feel superior to them, then you're not listening. You're judging. At the very heart of the gospel is a man who has infinite power and who gives it up in sacrificial service for others and loves and forgives the people who disagree with him so much that they're opposing him, so much that they're destroying him. And Christianity says, you're not saved by your performance. You're not saved by being smart or good, but you're saved because Jesus Christ died for you. Therefore, if you are saved, it's not because you're better than other people, not because you're smarter than other people. It's all because of God's grace. And when you understand that Jesus, the judge, was judged for you, that should wipe out, totally destroy your self-righteousness, your judgmental attitude. You're not going to look down on other people. You're not going to look down on other groups. Number two, how does this make you thankful? It makes you be thankful that forgiveness is possible. You should be thankful that forgiveness is possible. When you see that Jesus Christ was judged in your place, that means you forgive people who have wronged you. I'm talking about individuals now. Is there anybody in your life who's wronged you? And you say, you know, I'm not bitter. Yeah, I've forgiven them. But, you know, if the truth of the matter is you would really love it if something bad happened to them. I've forgiven them. I'm not bitter against them, but if a truck runs over me, that's okay with me. You know, I'm not bitter. I'm not angry. But, you know, if he got fired, man, my life would be so much easier. Do you know what you are? You're in the judgment seat. You think you know what they deserve. But Jesus Christ shows that we should forgive. And you say, well, how can I forgive? Here's Jesus Christ. Here's Jesus Christ, Matthew 26. He had every right to judge us. You and I don't have the right to sit in judgment on others, but he had the right. And he was he said, I refuse to sit in judgment. I bear your judgment. And if Jesus Christ can do that for you, then you can do it for others. Number three, how does this make you thankful? The fact that Jesus is the judge who was judged. Be thankful that you won't get your self-image from other people's judgment of you. I have to develop this one just a little bit. Hang on just a second. Be thankful that you won't get your self-image from other people's judgment of you. That simply means stop judging yourself all the time. If Jesus Christ is the judge who was judged, then you will stop judging yourself all the time. Some of us, some of you, walk around all the time always beating yourself up, always saying, I didn't do a good job, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not handsome, I'm not smart, I'm not as good, I'm not doing what I ought to be doing, look at myself, I'm awful, I'm terrible. Well, what is that? When you do that, you're sitting on the judgment seat of your life and you're looking down at yourself. Every single day of your life, if your performance is okay, well, that's all right. But if your performance isn't very good, then you beat yourself up, you get depressed, you're down in the dumps, nobody even wants to be around you because you're so gloomy. How dare you look at yourself that way? How dare you? The only person who has the right to sit in judgment over you and smack you around is Jesus Christ. And he didn't do it. At infinite cost, he got up out of that chair, out of that judgment seat, and he took your sins upon himself. I love this passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, where the Apostle Paul is responding to people who are judgmental of him. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 3 and 4. He says, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. In Jesus Christ, my judgment day is in the past. All the bad things that I deserve are gone. They're in the past. And now the verdict is in. The trial is over. The self-recrimination should be over. The trial is over. So what I'm trying to say is stop acting like you're on trial all the time. The verdict is in. He loves you. He accepts you. So what do you think about that? Get out of the judgment seat toward other groups. Get out of the judgment seat toward other individuals, other people. Get out of the judgment seat towards yourself. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a conscience and when you sin, you shouldn't get... of course, that's true. What I'm talking about is letting other people and letting circumstances and letting yourself shape your own self-image rather than have the view of self as forgiven, as a child of God, a son of the King of Kings who has been freed and redeemed and transformed into the image of Christ. Number four, why should this make you thankful? Be thankful that Jesus suffers with you. Jesus Christ does not just suffer for us, he suffers with us. And in his trial here, he identifies with the poor and oppressed. He identifies with the powerless. He identifies with people who are victims of injustice. He identifies with people who've been crushed by the ways of the world, by the economy and the political powers of the world, by all these systems that have crushed people for their own benefit. He didn't just suffer for you. He suffered with you. Jesus Christ came to earth. God became man and moved right into our powerlessness, right into our injustice, right into the oppression. And he experienced it. He lived it. Hey, life isn't fair. Jesus Christ knows all about that. John Stott at one point says something like, I could never believe in God if it wasn't for the cross. In a world filled with injustice, how could it be possible to worship a God who was immune from it? Christianity is the only faith that says God experienced it. He lived it. Therefore, he understands and he knows what we're dealing with. He cares about it. Jesus Christ is the judge who was judged. He was judged for you. And that ought to make you thankful. that I don't just serve a God who sits out there on the throne of the universe watching me down here struggle with my life and struggle with my cancer and struggle with my difficult co-workers and have difficulty in my marriage, just watch out there observing and like watching rats in a cage. That's how some people view God. Jesus Christ is the God who came and lived in it and experienced it, and he knows and he loves you. He gave himself for you. Now, here's the question. Jesus Christ says, I am the judge of all the earth. I am the King of kings and Lord of lords. I am the Son of God. I am the Son of Man. I am the one whom God sent to redeem sinners, and I am the one whom God is sending to make right all the wrongs on this earth. What will you do with him? How will you answer him? You can get angry, try to beat him up, put him on trial. You can get scared and run away. Or you can fall on your feet and worship him. Let's stand together.